And it is almost 2:30 p.m. Stay tuned for Ecologic, and this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Every day is Earth Day. I'm Ken Gale.
I'm Sally Gellert.
And I'm Donna Stein, and this is Ecologic for February 18th, 2022.
When your air or water are clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said.
Today, solutions to the climate crisis, leaders in decarbonization and energy efficiency.
Our guests, Bomi Jung and Christina McPike, will tell us more. Welcome to Ecologic. Bomi, please introduce yourself.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Bomi Jung, and I have been working in the affordable housing sector for the past 17-ish years, all of that time focused on getting climate action in affordable housing.
And Christina?
Hi, everybody. My name is Christina McPike. I'm the Director of Energy and Sustainability at Wind Companies, which is an affordable housing developer based in Boston. And we are committed to preserving and creating high-quality housing with a strong focus on sustainability.
And what do you do to make buildings greener? We'll start with you, Bomi.
In my career, I've really been focused on doing energy efficiency retrofits and basically fixing up older affordable housing buildings. So not so much on building new buildings, which is an area that's had a lot of progress over the last 15-ish years, and a lot of really exciting things are happening in new construction. But as you all know, most of the buildings that we're going to have in 2050 are buildings that already exist today. And so it's really important to reinvest in them. particularly when it comes to affordable housing, there's affordable housing stock has a tendency to be older when it's a sort of what we call naturally occurring affordable housing in particular. And then there's also just the fact that, you know, as with any building, affordable housing needs reinvestment periodically. And so there's both a recurring opportunity to make these kinds of improvements that are responsive to the challenge of climate, as well as, I think, an obligation socially that we've recognized in this country for a long time that we need to provide quality housing to folks who can't afford to get it on the market.
Sure. Christina?
We think about the energy performance of our buildings every day, and we own a lot of buildings. We own about 15,000 apartments, and we manage another 100,000 apartments all over the country. And we think about greening our buildings as an asset manager might and as a capital planning team for a real estate portfolio owner might. The actual upgrades and things that we're talking about here are, you know, related to the building envelope. How well insulated is it? How airtight is it? How good are our windows and our, you know, our overall building shell, as well as ventilation? Are we providing balanced fresh air, and are we able to recapture the exhaust air out of our buildings so as to not waste too much energy while also balancing fresh air requirements? And also the way in which we're heating and cooling our buildings and also producing hot water. So it really touches all aspects of the building, and we care about all of those the systems in the building. So there's really no, I'd say, typical energy efficiency measure or project, or at least there hasn't been in the past, where there's some really exciting things happening around the sort of standardization of deep energy retrofits, which we can get into. But typical sort of greening efforts might include, you know, upgrading HVAC systems in a building and adding insulation to the building and things like that.
I just about to ask you what makes your buildings so different than somebody else's buildings.
I think it's really important to, I think it's really important for people to realize that we're not just green buildings. It's not an abstract. This is really the health of the building is really the health of everyone living in the building. This for everybody's own good that this gets done. And this is a, becomes a revolution in both old buildings and new buildings.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, buildings, I think Romy and I are both really enjoy buildings. We like buildings. We're green building geeks. Buildings are physical, tangible assets that we can get our hands on. We can monitor every data point in that building. We can know what the energy profile of that building looks like. We can learn a lot about that building. It isn't hypothetical or theoretical. And our buildings look a lot like anybody else's buildings. We have low-rise garden-style apartments. We have mid-rise, you know, 4 to 7-story elevator buildings. And we have towers that are 20 stories tall with 400 units in them, you know, in different climate zones. And each of those buildings performs differently depending on the types of systems and the vintage of the building and so forth. But, yeah, they all look the same. What we also don't really have is a standard sort of performance objective. How should an existing building perform? I think there's a sort of minimum baseline that we all want to think that our buildings are healthy and code compliant and comfortable, and that could vary depending on building owner and even municipality depending on the code. But to the extent that we can align, you know, energy efficiency projects with those kind of fundamental rights for our tenants and ourselves, you know, the more progress we'll be able to make in implementing projects.
What's most important to be in a building code in order to encourage green, you know, more decarbonization?
So the question was, what's important to include in the building codes to encourage decarbonization? Yeah. So there are a number of regulatory efforts that are underway across the country, and I'll use New York as an example. That's just what the, you know, where I work and where the city that I know best. So building codes are you should think about building codes as sort of like the floor, right? That's what we're minimally asking everyone to build to, right? And it's also important to note that when it comes to building codes, they're triggered. Building codes are triggered when you do something that is substantial enough in the building that you have to meet the current building code. And so when you change the building code, it doesn't mean that all of a sudden all of the existing buildings are going to have to be brought up to that code. It'll take a certain amount of time because you have to basically, in order to trigger a portion of the building code, you have to touch that portion, you know, as part of a renovation. And so building codes are, there's a reason why we use the phrase code minimum, right? Building codes are supposed to be the floor, the quality floor. And then it takes a period of time for the building, a change in the building code to result in changes in the actual building stock. So there are a number of other ways that building owners can be motivated to make upgrades. One is, as I mentioned earlier, there is a capital cycle that buildings have to go through because, again, you know, you put up a building and, you know, it degrades over time and it needs reinvestment. And so when you have in a highly regulated sector like the affordable housing sector, when you have these relatively well-known periods when you know that you're going to have an investment being made in that building, that's a really opportune time to be able to say, let's do it differently, let's do it better. And that's something that I think where Christina works has done really well over the years and really shown other owners how to take advantage of those kinds of opportunities. So there's that recapitalization opportunity. Another part of it is incentives, of course, right? So in New York State, we've got a lot of incentives that are, it's basically saying, I'm going to pay you to try to do something differently. Not just as sort of like, not just to say, you know, you're motivated by this carrot of the money, but really the idea is that as a real estate owner, we're asking you to take risk in some way, or we're asking you to do something that you don't have the resources for. And so we're going to, it's not a reward. It is a enabling capital to be able to do work. And then lastly, I think where we've seen a lot of movement more recently in the regulatory side has been around setting performance targets that are explicitly geared towards building performance or energy performance around and carbon performance. And so this would be, for example, in New York City, we have Local Law 97. There is, you know, a building performance law that passed in D.C. There are a number of cities where these kinds of sort of not the floor, not the, this is not the minimum that you have to build, but over time you have to reach a certain performance, right? So you're saying work towards this outcome over the next 5 years, over the next 10 years, or whatever it may be. So it gives you a clear market signal as to not where you have to be right now, but where you need to be in 5 or 10 years.
And unlike a code, it's not triggered by work or rehab. You could do nothing in your building. It's a mandate that's performance-based, like Bomi said, and it is going to be very relevant to your building. You have to respond to it. So it is the stick to the carrot that is the incentive. And Boston has a relatively new carbon emission standard as well, BERDO policy, similar to BEPS in D.C. and the Local Law 97 here in New York.
So with buildings being one of the biggest places that energy is used, it sounds like little by little, buildings are becoming more efficient over time. Is that fair to say that we're looking at a better future as far as how buildings use energy?
I think Bomi alluded to the advances that we've been able to make in new construction, and that's absolutely true, especially and maybe ironically in affordable housing industry, unlike the market rate luxury housing developers. But we're building really well today compared to how we built buildings even as recently as 5 years ago. I will say that's regional. You know, it depends on what building code you're responding to. More importantly, it depends on the financing that you're using. a lot of affordable housing developers are competing for subsidies that are, you know, highly competitive, and a way to compete and secure that funding is by making really, you know, making commitments around your high performance goals. And so if you can commit to a passive house certification or net zero or all electric with battery storage, you know, you can attract the resources to do those really, really high performance, really good buildings.
What does passive house mean?
Passive house is originally a German standard. The Passive House Institute in the United States is an amazing organization. I'll refer to it as FIAS. It's a performance standard for buildings. And so similar to LEED and Energy Star, FIAS is I would say far more advanced. It's a building science standard. It's not really a green building standard. And it sets, you know, basically a peak heating and cooling demand and overall source energy cap that a building can use. So if you're a FIAS, if you want your building to be a FIAS certified building, you have to design it and model it in such a way to prove that it will not exceed these heating and cooling demand thresholds or caps and the kilowatt hour per person cap. And you do that by designing a very well, highly insulated building envelope that has no thermal bridging and is super airtight, 5 times more airtight than a code compliant building is today. Very little or no fossil fuels, so you're usually heating and cooling with heat pumps. Your heating and cooling loads your heating load is much smaller because your building envelope is so robust. And most of your mechanical load in your building is ventilation related, and you're achieving balanced high efficiency ventilation with an energy recovery ventilation system. So they're super energy efficient buildings.
And Bomi, you're on the board of New York Passive House.
I do serve on the board of New York Passive House. Actually, it's not to get all too weedy, but we actually have multiple standards for passive house in the U.S. There is the standard that came over from Germany, which is an international standard, and it's not modified in any way when it goes from place to place. So the passive house standard that applies in, you know, Venezuela is the same passive house as in Germany. And then we have the FIA standard is one that's been adapted more to fit the climate conditions in the U.S. And has a process that is very U.S.-based as far as the way that the standard is managed. And then there's actually a third standard, which is it's a proposed standard through ASHRAE, which is the standard-setting body that isn't a sort of a private label standard. I guess, you know, it can seem confusing when I talk about it that way. I think that for me, the way I think about it, and I'm not an architect and I'm not an engineer, but the way that I think about it is, you know, I started learning about building science and building science being sort of, you know, a combination of how to build the best buildings that we know how to build and then sort of measuring so that we know that we actually built the best building that we know how to build. And so for me, Passive House is just, regardless of which of the standards we're talking about, it's really just a shorthand for saying we built the best building that we know how to build using building science that we know today.
And speaking of building science, I think Chris Benedict has been in the forefront of that for a long time. And I know both of you know her. So could you say a few words about one of our pioneers?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, I was always a little bit annoyed because you know, when green buildings started to be covered in the media, it more likely than not, it was going to be like some story about how like great things are happening in Germany and why can't we do what, you know, the Germans are doing. And I was always a little bit annoyed by that because my introduction to building science was through NESE, which is the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association, and, you know, the great people who've been working on building science here in the Northeast and in New York, and Henry Gifford, her engineering partner, among them. And so I had toured those buildings. I had seen the evolution of how those ideas were applied. Sort of, you know, one project had a certain focus. You know, they figured it out and they took it to the next project. They added something on. You know, and that was the way that in the affordable housing sector in New York, that's how we learned to build these really fantastic buildings that we have today, is by, you know, developers and by architects and engineers trying it out in real buildings, you know, a little at a time, you know, to the extent that they were able to take on that little bit of incremental risk of doing something new, right? So it's really hard to go from doing something one way and then all of a sudden the next day do it an entirely different way. And so when you see a really fantastic building in New York City, and we've got a lot of really high-performance, amazing buildings in New York in affordable housing, that didn't come from nowhere, right? That came from, 20 years of incremental learning by the affordable housing developers, by the architects and engineers.
Yeah, I love the fact that there's such a large movement right now of women in green women architects.
Yeah.
And I know you guys are just wonderful and right at the top of the curve here. But there are a lot of people like you who are working in the system and of course influenced by Chris Benedict. Do the green women of green work with each other? Do you all get together? I guess we know you from the Women of Green conference. So talk a little bit about the network that's around.
There's some great.
We're running out of time, so 30 seconds.
Yeah, there are amazing women in this field, and Chris Benedict is one of them. I've learned so much from Chris in the last year just about EFIS. She's redefining the way that we wrap buildings and insulate them from the outside, which is really exciting. Mm.
Boy, as usual, time flies by, and we have to watch the clock, so we do need to wrap it up. But thanks everybody for joining us. For more information, you can reach Bomi Jung. Bomi, please give a contact information for you real quick.
Sure. You can find me at bomi@bomi.com. That's bomee.com.
Okay. And Christina McPike.
You can email me at cmcpike@winco.com.
Great. Join us in 2 weeks on Friday, March 4th, for our memorial tribute to superstar activist Connie Hogarth.
And we have information on a variety of environmental topics, such as supporting DEC's denial of Dan Scammer's air permit or the Black Climate Week coming up. And if you want to listen to this show or any of our past shows again, it's all at www.ecoradio.org.
That's www.ecoradio.org.
Mainstream media won't give you all this information that Christina and Bomi have just shared with you. Their corporate profit interests will never broadcast these details. That's why Ecologic and WBAI are so important. We need to exist.
It's you, the listener, who has the power to keep Ecologic on the air. Help us to continue to bring you important news, information, and entertainment. Radio might seem free, but there are costs, and our listener-supported radio station needs you.
Go to www.give2wbai.org and choose Ecologic on the drop-down menu after you click on Next, or call 212-209-2950 and say that you want to be a member or a BAI buddy. Put Eco-Logic in the search box and see the environmental DVDs and CDs that are available for a donation to WBAI.
Like so many producers here at WBAI, we are volunteers and work hard every week to bring you new information and guests who are on the front lines of many environmental issues. Pledging now during this show really helps Ecologic especially.
Also, those of you online, please sign up for our email list to stay connected with us. Those of you on social media, search for Eco-Logic.
Don't forget to comment on Dan Scammer and keeping fracking waste out of our New York City, New Jersey water supply. Links are on our website.
And thanks to our terrific engineer, Reggie Johnson. We couldn't do this without you.
I'm Ken Gale.
I'm Sally Gellert.
And I'm Donna Stein. Join us March 4th for our tribute to Honey Connie Hogarth.
Solar power, inexpensive energy.
From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, February 18th. Here are some headlines. Nearly 4 million American children fell into poverty in the month of January due to the expiration of the expanded child tax credit at the end of last year. According to new data released Thursday by Columbia University, there was a 41% increase in child poverty between December and January as millions of families stopped receiving the extra $300 a month check. The study noted that Latino and Black children experienced the largest percentage point increases in poverty. Democrats passed the expanded child tax credit as part of their pandemic relief bill in March of last year. The last of those payments went out in December as opposition from Republican senators and Democratic Senator Joe Manchin stopped an extension of the program. The Build Back Better Act calls for extending the program for years, but that bill remains stalled in Congress. Kimberly Potter, the white former Minneapolis police officer who fatally shot Dante Wright after saying she mistook her gun for a taser, was sentenced today to 2 years behind bars. Potter was found guilty of first-degree and second-degree manslaughter in the April 2021 killing of the 20-year-old Black man last year during a traffic stop. County District Judge Regina Chu sentenced Potter to 2 years imprisonment, significantly less than the 7 years prosecutors asked for and which is recommended by state sentencing guidelines. Wright's family also asked for the maximum sentence allowable. During today's hearing, Wright's mother, Katie Wright, said to Potter, quote, "I'll never be able to forgive you for what you've stolen from us," close quote. Once the sentence was announced, Wright's family denounced it as too lenient and accused the judge of being taken in by a white woman's tears. The percentage of U.S. adults who identify as LGBTQ has doubled over the past decade from 3.5% in 2012 to 7.1% in 2021, and that number is only expected to go up, according to a Gallup poll released Thursday. According to Jeff Jones, the author of the poll, people who identify as LGBTQ could make up to 10 to 15% of the adult population, as Gen Z and millennials comprise an increasing share of the adult population. And the results are more pronounced among women. Gen Z women are roughly 3 times more likely than men to identify as LGBTQ, and millennial women are about 2 times as likely than men to identify as such, according to Gallup. Jeff Jones says the increasing number of young adults self-identifying as LGBTQ underscores changing societal norms. And a New York judge ruled Thursday that Donald Trump and 2 of his adult children must testify under oath as part of the New York Attorney General's civil fraud investigation into the former president and his company. Judge Arthur Engoron denied Trump's effort to quash the subpoenas, rejecting arguments that New York Attorney General Letitia James is conducting a politically motivated investigation that is depriving the Trumps of their constitutional rights. The judge ordered Trump to comply with the subpoena within 14 days. Donald Trump Jr. and Ivanka Trump have 21 days to sit for a deposition. Barring a successful appeal, Trump would face a decision between answering questions under oath or invoking his Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination. Trump has often equated such silence with evidence of guilt. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 43 degrees under fair skies. In New York City, 41.